bury it and make it secure. They could have no conception of whom I served, and even if they did, I guess they would pay it little attention. I don't know how long it took me to reach the center. Probably a long time, dragged out by stumbling. Eventually, though, I saw the Xenos gate soaring up before me, and I saw the stars under its arch blur and tremble, and knew I was close. He was there, waiting. I had no idea then just how far he had come, nor what perils he had mastered, but he was there. He was surrounded by his great and austere counselors and champions, none of whom so much as looked at me. They conferred among themselves, looking to their weapons, every movement thick with fatigue. I knew who he was. I recognized the pictures from the devotional tracts. We had been served with those images from childhood, told to meditate on them incessantly, even to pray to them, instructed never to let them out of our mind. Quadrillions had seen those templates of heroism and reflected on the glory that had been, using them as exemplars of the human spirit and hoping, perhaps even heretically, that they would return one day. I never thought it would happen. I did not believe it possible. I thought the masses were ignorant and weak, and that our salvation could only come from those powers we still retained, not the legends of a half-remembered past. Alone, of all those assembled there, he noticed me limping amid the giants. He looked past the custodians who stood there, their spears streaked with blood. He looked past the captains of the Space Marines and the grotesque lords of Mars, and fixed me with cold blue eyes. I could feel my heart racing out of control. The whole place was like an intoxicated dream, a phantasm sent to drain the last sanity from our tortured bodies, and yet I could not deny its reality. When he spoke, the voice was accented strangely, almost unintelligibly, the voice of another age. Despite my attire, he knew instantly who I was from the sigils of office on my environment suit, and was careful to address me with the utmost precision. "Cancellarius Senatorum Imperialis," he said. It was only then that any of the others turned towards me. There was a shield captain close by in burnished gold, one I should perhaps have recognized, but by then it was a challenge merely to remain conscious. I fell to my knees. "The Lord Gilliman," I said, using both the given name and the ceremonial one, united in this one soul 10,000 years before. "You speak for the High Lords?" he asked. I nodded. I could hardly bear to look into that face. There was something both beatific and horrific about it, an abundance of power that was almost obscene. He was of another age. He was a myth that died. He took a single step towards me, extending a vast gauntlet chased in gold and cobalt in order to lift me to my feet. "Then it is good you are here, Chancellor," Robute Gilliman said. "I have been away a long time. Perhaps, if your offices still extend to such things, you would be good enough to show me to your masters."
Chapter 14. Valerian. They came. The Grey Knights, whom we had always had uneasy relations with, answered our summons. I do not know if it was my request that prompted the order, or if Valoris had been petitioned by others. In any case, we were not so proud that we could not ask for help when it was needed. There is a profound distinction to be made here. We could both, Custodian and Grey Knight, slay demons. We were both, to all intents and purposes, immune to their temptations, and we were both effective against their many stratagems. There are two great repositories of law against the demonic in the Sol system, our own archives in the Tower of Hegemon, and the far greater librarium lodged on Titan itself. We are, as orders, steeped to our very cores in the fight against the great enemy. Perhaps you might say, chaos is the reason for both of our existences. And yet we are different. Remember I told you that we were never warriors, not exclusively. We are certainly not an army, and we were intended, in the original scheme, for service in an empire that never came to be. Our cousins in the chamber militant of the Ordo Malleus, by contrast, were forged exclusively for this singular war against our most powerful and enduring foe. They have no other purpose. Just like the Space Marines from whose template they were drawn, they are an army, complete and self-sufficient. We always knew of their existence. There are records held privately in the depths of our archives which chronicle their creation. We watched 10,000 years ago as he embarked on his last gambit. As the great enemy drew close to Terra, we observed the darkening of Saturn's moon and knew that one day it would return, its purpose fulfilled. Consider what this history means. We know that they came after us, the more junior creation, and yet they were as closely associated with him as we were. We both of us look to him and him alone as our progenitor, and share the same sense, cultivated over the wearing eons, that we enact his designs when all others falter. There are some among my brothers who do not see the Sons of Titan as much more than specialized space marines, to be regarded with suspicion as part of that schismatic breed that caused us so much anguish in the past. A space marine may always fail, they believe, given enough time and enough reason, and thus they are all part of the same potentially aberrant strain. Some think that. Others, and I myself have often speculated in such a vein, cultivate a different misgiving. We know well enough that they were designed as his last great weapon, fitted to an age that he foresaw near the end of his earthly embodiment. What if it were they, not us, who most faithfully embodied his final legacy? You will never hear one of us say as much out loud, but that does not mean the suspicion does not exist. It skulks around the corridors of Hegemon like a foul odor, faint but hard to eradicate. From the Speculum Certus, we know we were the finest and the most faithful. In the Speculum Obscurus, there is, as always, more doubt. Such, then, is the cause of the uneasiness between us. In practice, this rarely proved an issue, since they were not generally on Terra and we were never on Titan. Now, of course, that had changed. They sent fewer warriors than we asked for, less than half of one of their brotherhoods. Many of the Grey Knights were stationed far from the Sol system, it is true, but still the response felt somewhat paltry. They must have known what it would have cost our Captain General to make the request, and it was hard to think that the slight was not an intentional one. It was many days before I was to encounter one of the new arrivals myself. I had been occupied prosecuting the defense of my wall sector in conjunction with Urbo's forces. Despite our efforts, the unnatural tide of violence had only grown worse. Demagogues surfaced, once buried fast in the heart of the world city, now raising whole hosts of disciples. Some were truly corrupted, seeded many years ago, and now bursting into fruit. But others were merely deluded and desperate, their minds turned by the terrors in the sky and their stomachs empty. Soon the walls were attacked nightly, and our troops were busy emptying their lasguns at the charging hordes. It was sickening work, and even Urbo became deadened by it. My services were called on to eradicate the masters of this disorder, and I found myself at the heart of wearying fighting, slaying those freely who I'd once protected from a distance. Some of the corrupted had become dreadful by then, semi-human creatures with the marks of the traitor on their flesh. The greatest of them had accepted foul gifts, making them both lethal and persuasive to the masses. I slew men with embryonic wings sprouting from their spines, and women with fangs, and half-human, half-beasts. In time, it became clear that the zones south of the Lion's Gate were deteriorating rapidly. Aside from punitive raids, we lost effective control of most of the populated regions outside the wall, and the old cathedrals became wells of depravity. I hunted freely in those places, as did my brothers, but soon Urbo's patrols had to be doubled, then doubled again, and still they were ambushed and destroyed by the growing mobs of the damned. I looked into the skies and saw only the blood curdle now, a skein of crimson that flecked the skies and made it lurid. We had neither sunlight nor proper nightfall, just a constant glow of madness that chased out sleep and made the holy places seem like the haunts of ghouls. We could neither feed nor protect the innocent who remained in those vast regions of the city, and our inquisitors stalked among the seething hive spires as if lost on some long-forgotten death-world. Such were the circumstances in which I met Justicar Alcuin. It would have been better, I am sure, had our paths crossed in other times. As it was, though, the circumstances of our encounter were very far from ideal, taking place on the night that none can forget, only the second time in history that the outer walls were breached by the enemy, an event which would later be called, by its survivors, the Sack of the Lion's Gate. I led an attack company drawn from the best of Urbo's remaining forces. They were becoming hardened to what they saw by then, and were now able to give me useful support when we encountered creatures of the ether. 200 of them took off with me from the high landing stages, exiting the wall under the watchful cover of the defense batteries before heading out into the city beyond. Our target was the Manufactorum Zone, east of the Grand Processional, within sight of the Lion's Gate itself. Once a proud thoroughfare, 300 meters wide, used to hosting military parades, it had become a haunted semi-ruin, overlooked by eyeless rows of scorched terraces. We launched repeated missions to keep it clear, mostly to provide a route for ground forces retreating to the walls from positions further out. During the nominal daylight hours, we drove the corrupted hosts back into the shadows, but as night fell and the flames danced more darkly, they always slunk back. So here we were again, roaring out into the eternal city, clearing the filth from sight of the walls. It felt like trying to scoop the tide away, handful by handful. I took Italian gunship in the lead, and the bulk of Urbo's soldiers followed in their Valkyries. Once beyond the walls, we dropped down low, skirting no more than 50 meters over the deserted transit canyons. Vast hive walls loomed up on either side of us, many still sullenly burning, most as dark as pitch. Billions still dwelled inside those sarcophagi, though I did not like to think on how many still retained their sanity. Ragged banners hung from burned-out windows, all inscribed with signs of ruin. It didn't matter how many we tore down. Within hours, hundreds more would reappear. "Target approaches, Colonel," I voxed, watching the massive gates of an old Munitorum works emerge out of the smoggy haze.
"Prep for disembark,"
he passed on to his sergeants, and the Valkyries dropped even lower. Urbo and I had formed something of an effective partnership. Once his awe of me had dissipated a little, I discovered I could rely on him to follow a command. Once he'd witnessed me slaughter in the Emperor's name, he discovered that I could be a killer after his own heart. It is surprising, I find, what connections can be made in adversity. The gates to the facility were broken, and on either side of them, thick bulwarks soared into the flickering air. The entire place was a labyrinth of smelters, forges, and assembly lines, built eons ago, when Terra had presumed to manufacture things for itself, afterwards used to recycle defunct military equipment too high value to destroy, and too low value to export off-world. Our transports growled under the low lintel, plunging us into a penumbral world of muffled echoes. I was first out, crunching down onto a wet floor strewn with swarf. The rest of Urbo's men piled out from hovering Valkyries, then sprinted across the resounding floor of the chamber, their lasgun-mounted lumens flashing in the dark. The place was like some colossal mausoleum, with a high, empty roof that disappeared into gloom. They had serviced Militarum super-heavies in here, I had been informed, and there were still chain-lifters hanging amid the blown shells of dormant machine clusters. It stank of sour oil and rotting metal. I could already hear our enemies. They no longer made any attempt to hide their presence in those places, but conducted their depravities as if they were safely ensconced on some world far from our scrutiny. The fact that they dared it at all disgusted me, a blasphemy I could no longer show indulgence to. So I ran hard, delving deeper into the echoing depths. Empty cage lifts hung like lanterns in the dark, rusting quietly over abyssal shafts. From ahead, I could smell the chemical stench of burning and hear the roar of the crowds. I saw cloaked figures scuttle into the gloom, but ignored them. The real prey was ahead, congregating, organizing, making ready to surge out against us. Urbo's troops kept up as best they could, but they soon fell behind. I pulled ahead, driven by my zeal to end this, running faster and deeper into those stinking foundations. I broke into what had once been an assembly hall. The conveyor belts were still in place, some with the carcasses of battle tanks lurking like monuments. The space was filled now with swaying masses, all clad in the ragged remains of their work shifts. It was a shrine to corruption, that place. Human bodies hung from chains locked into the distant ceiling, twisting amid fetid air, their eyes gouged out and their hands skinless. Huge eight-pointed stars had been graven into the walls with the facility's own machine tools, then daubed with the residue of slaughter. On top of the smell of engine lubricants, I could now detect human aromas. Blood, sweat, desperation. The mob of faces was turned away from me and angled up towards a Mechanicus command pulpit, a hovering mass of intricate metalwork, studded with cables and clattering with extended mechadendrites. That thing had the capacity for, perhaps, 20 tech priests, but was now crawling with 10 times that number of occupants. They were scratching and clawing at one another, swarming like rats over it, shinning up the cables and clambering towards the summit. Atop that pulpit was a single priest in ripped ecclesiarchy robes, though the old sigils of the ministerium had been excised and replaced by crude octets. The priest held aloft a still-shivering heart in two blood-slicked hands, offering it up like a benediction. Bodies of imperial troops from 100 different regiments lay strewn over the conveyor approaches, all with their chests ripped open and their ribs glistening whitely. Many more, still living, had been corralled into makeshift cages hewn from the rusting hulls of the tanks, ready to be dragged for sacrifice by the hordes who bayed around them. All pretense at sanity had gone. The thousands of souls who jeered and cried out looked barely human anymore. Their skin was white, their eyes ringed with black, their tongues of virulent red. Bleeding tattoos had been carved onto their faces with blunt knives, and metal splinters rammed through skin folds. They were no longer afraid of me, no longer afraid of anything. Their systems force-fed hallucinogens and stimulants by the demagogues who had dragged them into this debauchery. I did not hesitate. I charged into their midst. I tore through them, slaying rapidly and carving a path towards the pulpit. Behind me, I heard the first of Urbo's troops arrive, and the flash of lasfire soon competed with the leaping brazier flames to banish the shadows. Gnosis whirled in a reaper pattern, carving through the diseased flesh. They shrieked and they cursed, throwing themselves towards me. Dozens pressed in, then hundreds, clawing out, their eyes locked wide with demented fury. Not one of them even touched my armor. I surrounded myself with a hemisphere of tattered flesh, an orbit of thrown blood that spun and splattered. I moved ever faster, my pace barely slowed by the methodical killing. I immersed myself in my combat state of pure concentration. I didn't see those wretches as individual targets at all, just one vast, many-headed beast standing between me and my ultimate goal. They died so quickly, depressingly quickly, like dry fuel hurled into the furnace. Heavy weapons cracked out, telling me that Urbo's ranged attack squads were in place. Assault teams headed for the cages, aiming to release as many of their comrades as they could, while the bulk of the regular troops engaged the acolytes. I was close to the pulpit by then, and could feel the air thicken, just as it had done in the Cathedral of the Relic. The screams ramped up, the flames leapt higher. The priest sacrificed another struggling victim on his false altar, even as I drew into bolter range, oblivious to everything save the rite he was orchestrating. By then, I could see just how many had been slain. There were piles of skulls, blood-streaked and flesh-pocked, stacked up beyond the pulpit like a conqueror's horde. I hurled Gnosis around in a heavy crossways swipe, clearing space to leap. Even as I did so, the air ahead of me cracked open, shriven by a sudden blast of frost-hard energy, flooring those who still howled and capered, and causing the pulpit itself to rock wildly. Five clear shafts of eye-burning lightning speared down from the void above us, crystallizing into the outlines of silver-gray warriors bearing force halberds and crackling warhammers. They slammed into the heart of the enemy, scattering them with the force of their arrival before instantly bursting into choreographed killing movement. I adapted, assessing how the new arrivals interlocked with my assault, gauging speeds and impacts. Soon we were fighting together, cutting our way higher and hurling the crushed and broken bodies into the conveyors. We closed the gap, vaulting up to the pulpit's high platform, seizing its crustaceous exhaust vents and hauling ourselves onto it. My blade was the quickest. I reached the high platform in time to see the priest tear the living heart from a final victim. I cast down the stim-bulked bodyguards who lumbered to engage me and angled Gnosis to discharge. The human sacrifice was thrown aside, bouncing awkwardly down the slope of skulls. The priest grinned at me. He held the heart aloft and crushed it between his fingers, dousing his bald head in a lumpy torrent of liquid gore.
"You see, though, we've done enough," he told me.
My bolt shell hit him in the chest, blowing him from the platform. The charge ignited while he was in midair, rending him open and sending his severed limbs spinning into the crowds. The Grey Knights joined me. Their steel-grey armor still sizzled from the extremes of teleportation, and the Homer beacons on their shoulders throbbed with residual power. Four of them bore mighty blades that crackled with neon-blue disruptor charge, while their leader carried a heavy warhammer inscribed with runes of purity.
"We come too late," said their leader.
I turned on him. The hall was now in confusion, the mobs running from Urbo's advance, throwing themselves into the las volleys like startled cattle.
"What do you mean?"
I asked. "We would kill them all now. By dawn, this place would be purged of its corruption."
"This is ended here."
His helm was caked in a dirty brown film of blood, all except the lenses, which glowed with blue fire. I could sense the psychic essence radiating from his core. It was like heat leaking from his every gesture. He was perhaps a head shorter than I was, a little less heavily built. His armor was scoured raw, where mine was ornate, and his movements were a fraction slower, though every part of him was suffused with the arcane potency of the warp.
"Not yet,"
he said, keeping the shimmering psi field activated over his great hammerhead.
"Attend, custodian. Now the storm breaks."
Even before he had finished speaking, the walls began to shake. The heavy chains swung, first gently, then ever more violently. With a squeal and a whine, the conveyors began to move, their skins drumming. A rumble broke out below us, a grind of earth against earth, almost too low to be heard. But then the reverberations thrummed into our bones. Urbo's men kept fighting. The mob kept coming at them. The mortals seemed insensible to this, and yet I could feel it. The build-up, the swell and the bulge of something uncurling and extending and thrusting into reality. This was something cumulative. This was something exponential.
"You sensed this,"
I said, sounding more accusatory than I had intended.
"We must leave,"
was all the Grey Knight said. The walls were cracking. The foundations were shifting. I looked out at the assembly hall and saw its floor begin to shudder, vibrating like kicked sand.
"Withdraw,"
I ordered Urbo over the vox. "Get out, now! Get to your ships!" His forces instantly complied, disengaging, pulling back the way they had come. I looked up. There were stairs leading up the far wall, hugging the adamantium panels and running sheer to the distant roof. The Grey Knight saw what I proposed and nodded.
"That is acceptable,"
he said. Then we were moving again, leaping from the pulpit and running across a heavy landscape of breaking metal. I felt the decks shatter under my tread. Wherever my boots landed, a red glow was revealed, as if we trod across magma skin. I could unleash my full power now, and sprinted at full tilt. The Space Marines kept pace, and the six of us swept across the disintegrating hall. As we went, huge chunks of iron fell around us, smashing apart and driving deep into the vaults below. One of the tank husks was struck and tilted straight over into widening chasms beneath. I reached the stairway and ascended, leaping four steps at a time. We rose swiftly, even as the walls buckled. Blood-red light flooded the chamber now, shafts of it angling from every rent in the toppling edifice around us. I had a vision of the entire structure collapsing as we raced through it, the tons and tons above us sloughing into a landslip of ruin. I leapt to one side, my movements governed by intuition, narrowly evading a column that crashed into dust. We ducked and swayed through the disintegrating galleries, showered with clouds of bouncing rubble. The noise became incredible, a roar like the forgotten oceans. I had a final glimpse of the vaults over the assembly chamber, imploding entirely, folding in on the halls below, before we reached the portal to the outside. I raced through it, followed by the others, even as the decking beneath us fell away and plunged into the gathering vortex of collapse. We emerged onto a high, narrow bridge into the spire levels and kept running. Behind us, the immense Munitorum facility broke open with blazing shafts of red light thrust out from its slumping profile of darkness. Slowly, agonizingly, like a mountain being consumed from within, the great buttresses folded in on themselves and the towers crumpled. I heard explosions from a long way down, booms of tortured stone giving in to tectonic pressures, and plumes of smoke reared high into the sky. The bridge began to sway, its moorings pulled from their armatures. Ahead of us was another portal set into the face of a rearing hive spire with a forked crown. We made for that, swerving and ducking, even as molten clumps of metal rained down around us. I had a blurred impression of everything. The towers, the domes, the great defense stations falling apart, as if all creation were splitting into pieces around us. I fixed on the goal. A wide platform of heavy iron and adamantium lodged high up on the westward face of the forked spire, and shut all else out of my mind. As the bridge finally broke free of its fastenings, we threw ourselves into the air, sailing through fire-flecked winds before crunching hard to the solid deck ahead. Behind us, the bridge twisted away like a headless snake, its spine broken, it seesawed as gravity sucked it down into the hungry maw of cataclysm. Another towering veil of dust rose up on the far side of the canyon, lit from within by fresh detonations. The overlapping sonic roar became blistering, overwhelming even my aural receptors and making my vision shake. I stared out west over to where the processional avenue led towards the Lion's Gate. As steeled as I was, as conditioned as I was, I could hardly credit the evidence of my senses. For a terrible moment, caught in that seismic upheaval, I lost any sense of location, of secure grounding. The primordial center had been cut loose. The terror I knew was gone. Gouts of hissing flame burst up from the transitways and the deep canyons, licking the sides of the tottering spires. The blazes were impossibly huge, merged conflagrations that thundered into the airless heights. I could just make out the wall on the far side of the heat-shaken night, blurry from the boiling clouds of burning ash. I could see the pinnacles of the basilicas thrusting skywards like ebony spears. The skies themselves had ignited, aching with fell illumination and riven by the bellowing of inhuman voices. I saw dozens of great edifices, all thousands of years old, dissolve into blackened dust, broken apart by the rituals enacted at their hearts. An absolute and unearthly psychic hatred, raw and condensed into dreadful purity, flooded across the ancient battlements and towers, like the gales of a crashing maelstrom. The Grey Knights stood beside me, their armor turned deep crimson by the unholy light. Their Justicar looked impassively into the night sky.
"Shards of Karneth,"
he intoned grimly.
So they truly dare it.
We could see across to the old Lionsgate void port reaches, huge expanses of rockcrete landing stages and command towers, interwoven with deep chasms where the ship lifts waited. Even in normal times it was a desolate place, marked for reverence by the ecclesiarchy and left bare for the winds to scrape against. But now it was a diabolic vision of torment. The great adamantium plates were heaving. Columns of liquid incandescence spat from the ruptures, jetting high into the weeping skies above. The wall, I said, preparing to race down from the spire's flank. Before I could move, however, an immense boom rang out, striking the spire faces and shattering their armor-glass view portals. The glittering rain of shards tumbled into cataracts, refracting the crimson aura and splaying it into rivers of rubies. Out across that immense vista, I saw the columns of flame solidify. Every point of lurid light began to intensify, thousands of them, tens of thousands, until the great plain resembled a starfield of its own, a bloody mirror to the one that cycled above the cloud barrier. They howled as they were born. I could only watch as they ripped into instantiation, first tens, then hundreds, then more and more, until the entire landscape was boiling with demon embryos. The nightmare infants stretched out, bathed in birth flames, their bodies extending upwards and outwards, their jaws distended in natal agony, their backs spawning spine-ridged spikes. They opened black-on-black eyes, they lashed with prehensile tongues, they staggered out of flaming cocoons, croaking from vocal cords that were already stiffening and taking up blades that erupted from firming scab flesh. They were in ranks. It was an infernal regiment, each one a cohort pulled from the mirror realm, burgeoning and unfolding until an entire war host stood before us. Soon I could no longer count them. A never-born army, filling the entire void port from end to end, spilling beyond its bounds and into the chasms and towers beyond, all lightning-crowned, all blood-slick, all screaming blasphemies at the spires of holy terror. Then greater horrors burst free of the world's shackles among them, slobbering behemoths with 100 eyes, iron-collared hounds that slavered and yanked at their thick chains, quasi-mechanical juggernauts with burning eyes and hunched smokestacks, more and more thrusting up from the tormented earth, exhumed amid cataclysms of fresh etherplasm. And finally, at the very apex, unfurled the greatest of all. They tore into existence with splintered bellows that annihilated the rockcrete around them, rising up into avatars of swirling detritus, higher and higher, bloating and firming into colossi of burnished muscle and flame-blackened brass. Immense bat wings fused and pushed out and stretched and enfleshed to beat the flame-torn skies, tattered and studded with chains and swinging skull bundles. Huge heads lifted up high, each crowned with heavy thickets of twisted horns and distended with tusk-crammed dripping jawlines. Mighty cloven hooves stamped, breaking the ground open into hissing blood channels. Two-handed axes swung into being, clotting from thick smoke before extending into twin-faced plates of warp-cursed steel, etched with runes of ending and glinting with the reflected stars of another plane. Barbed whips rippled through the flames, vast and curling and lashing with infernal acumen of their own. Bloodthirsters, 8 of them, forged in the image of mankind's oldest fears, the embodiments of battle rage and the avatars of bloodlust. These were myth-born titans of ruin. When they strode out, the horizon shuddered. When their pinions snapped, the flames thundered back greater. Wreathed in lightning, garlanded in black-edged flame, cloaked in the storm's surge, the mightiest of the mighty vassals of the Blood God raised their vast jowls skywards and roared. The clouds above us erupted, sending hammering channels of crimson rain slamming earthwards. The Neverborn army screamed, lashing out with their hooked blades, a chorus of feral ecstasy unleashed on a world they had coveted since the dawn of history. For a moment, it seemed as if the heavens themselves had formed the image of a giant horned face, as vast as the palace itself, leering in incipient triumph, before the vision was obliterated by the driving blood rain. The wall stood beyond them, gigantic and battle-scarred, towering higher than any hive spire and surmounted by the heaviest concentration of defences in all the Imperium. For the first time ever, I looked at it and saw in truth how fragile it was. It was a creation of men set against the infinite malice of gods. The instantiated host of the Neverborn, the immortal intelligences of the eternal ether, surged towards it now, thirsting to break apart the parapets they had founded on before. Before I knew it, I was running again. I was tearing down new stairwells and leaping from platforms, ramping up to full speed. My blade was snarling, setting golden flames dancing amid the bloody dark. Around me came the Grey Knights, silver ghosts in the gloom, their own weapons glittering sapphire. I knew every one of my brothers would be doing the same. All those on the wall and all those in the Eternal City would be racing to face this, to bring their blades to bear, to cut into the warp flesh that now rose up to extinguish all we had been born to preserve. And as I ran, only one thought possessed me, animated me, drove me onwards into the opening maw of living perdition. We cannot fail again.
Chapter 15. Alea. The black ship, Enduring Abundance, burned through the void, having taken its intended cargo on board. The Kadamara came along in its wake, flanked by a mini-fleet of similar warp-capable ships, a battered collection of largely ramshackle hulls that labored to remain in the larger vessel's wake. I didn't realize just how close we'd come. I'd been so consumed with survival that I'd never appreciated how remarkable our progress had been. By the time we were intercepted, we were within a warp stage of the Sol system. I had to hand it to Slovo. Despite his carping and moaning and physical frailty, he'd steered us superlatively, although whether he'd have been able to negotiate that last treacherous leg was hard to know. Our proximity to the goal, though, was what had saved us. The Enduring Abundance had been on its homeworld arc, brought back to the centre just ahead of the full impact of what Navradaran, in an echo of Slovo's words, was calling the Great Rift, the catastrophe that had scissored the galaxy in half. The Black Ship had not been originally scheduled to return to the Throne World for another 3 years, but Navradaran had boarded it and given the captain new orders. Its most precious cargo was no longer the shackled psykers that raged and sobbed in its holds, but the wardens who guarded them. But he had not been merely content with that, and had steered the ship on an erratic course back to Terra, taking in every known or rumoured convent of witch hunters in the subsector before setting the straight course home. The ship had never made it as far as Erasa, but others had told them of our existence, and so their astropaths had put their minds out into the ether, searching for the last scraps to recover before they would be buffeted back to their origin. Somehow they latched onto us and took the chance to reel us in. If we'd outrun them and tried to go it alone, I suspect we'd be dead by now. Our skeletons chewed on by gnaws. I'd never seen such a ship before. It was enormous, more than 20 times bigger than the Kadamara, and obviously ancient. I could hardly read the archaic Gothic inscriptions over the many cell doors, so mysterious were the cadences and vocabulary. The entire vessel was shrouded, the lumens kept low, and the corridors blanketed in darkness. The term black ship was not figurative. Every part of it was formed of ebon metal, faintly reflective, adorned and studded with ward patterns against corruption. Vast ether sinks took up the bulk of the lower hull, thrumming with constant Geller processes to discharge and eject the build-up of psychic energy on board. The huge crew, 3 times what would have been present on a similar Navy battleship, I guessed, prowled the corridors incessantly. Most were human normal, bearing the unmistakable mark of psycho-conditioning, and wielding strange weapons I didn't recognize, Some, though, were blanks, and some of those, like me, were anathema psychana. My first thought was that perhaps I knew some of them. Perhaps there were other refugees from Hestia's convent. It did not take long to disabuse me of that hope. These were a mongrel mixture of refugees from the League of Black Ships, or inquisitorial warbands, or such scattered convents as I'd been a part of. There were 45 of us in total, drawn from 12 different units, each with its own armor and insignias, and bitter histories. Once I'd had a chance to adjust to my new reality, Navradaran had explained the situation. He had been sent out into the void, as had others of his order, following orders from his captain general. The ether had been growing more turbulent for decades, and portents of disaster had been growing in intensity. The Sisters of Silence, having been allowed to drift into memory, were being collected together again. The final actions had been taken just in time. Any later and the rift would have made such a muster impossible. Even so, he suspected many hundreds of convents and black ships remained stranded on the far side, cut off from the light of the Astronomicon and unable to force passage home. As for us, we were little better off. The Enduring Abundance had a cadre of 20 navigators, almost all of them stronger and healthier than Slovo. The entire ship was warded and buttressed against demonic attack, with a crew of thousands, all trained from birth to detect the slightest manifestation of the Empyrean, and so they'd made better headway than us. Even so, Navradaran told me, they could not remain in the void for long. Each jump was escalating in danger, and they'd lost 3 of their navigators to madness on the last major haul. He professed surprise that we'd lasted as long as we had, and even more surprise that we'd managed to plot a route in the absence of the Astronomicon's guide. I didn't tell him about the map, which remained under guard on the Kadamara. In truth, I doubted whether it had been the thing that had saved us at all. Slovo claimed that it had been a poor compass, and that we had made our way largely through luck and instinct. But still, I didn't wish to have its presence disclosed. It was the one thing I had taken from the ruins of my past life, and I felt sure its existence meant something significant, but I would only share that with someone I could trust. You might think that was foolish, given the situation, and perhaps it was, but you must remember this. I was furious. My anger with the universe, which had always been there, always bubbling under, had burst out now. I saw in the Enduring Abundance just what could have been, had the Imperium not inexplicably lost faith in us. I saw the huge resources once placed under our direct control that the old Sisters of Silence had been trusted to administer. I looked at this custodian's fabulously decorated battle plate and saw the astonishing equipment he used, and looked at my chipped armor and thought of my rusting flamer. Whenever we conversed, always in thought mark, I felt that resentment clouding everything. You were not fighting, I wanted to tell him. We were here all the time, forgotten and left to fend for ourselves. You remained behind the walls, treated like gods, and now you presume to gather us to terror, beneficent and indulgent, as if we had been willful children ripe for scolding. I didn't express that to him, not in so many signs, but he must have detected my latent fury, for he wasn't stupid. The ship's armory was huge, and I was fitted out with better armor and better weaponry. It didn't wipe away the sense of injustice, but it did make me feel more lethal. I donned myself in golden armor with a rich purple cloak, just as my predecessors had worn, and replaced my old helm with a portcullis grille of pure oramite. I put my flamer aside and took up a great blade. It was an insane weapon, almost as tall as I was, but the extravagance appealed to me. All of us aboard spent long hours in training. There were other custodians alongside Navradaran, and they worked obsessively in the practice cages. I had to admit they were impressive to watch. They moved incredibly fast for their size, and I guess they would have taken out that black legionnaire on a racer far more efficiently than I had. I studied them for a long time, trying not to be too envious, and often failing. I came to hate their quiet, steady resolve. They never complained. They never got angry. Everything with them was polished and reverent, like diplomats somehow siphoned into the suits of warriors. I might have thought they were automata, had I not seen the way they moved a blade. Thrown, they were even well-spoken, and they treated me with such relentless politeness and consideration that I wanted to scream. That was the core problem. I needed an excuse to loathe them, and they wouldn't give me one. So I did what they did, took up my blade, and worked myself into a lather of exhaustion. I absorbed everything I could from them all, the custodians, my fellow sisters, even the Black Ship's senior garrison command, drinking in what my isolation had prevented me from learning across all those years. I don't know how long that journey lasted. It felt like weeks, but time in the warp passed as strangely as ever, and so that might be wrong. Navradaran was sure the whole time that we were headed back for war. He told me that over and over. Terra was already on a knife edge when I left, he said to me. There were portents, but they led us astray. The council was divided, and Valoris could see more clearly than anyone that we were heading for crisis. Hence this harvest. He smiled apologetically. My apologies, that sounds disrespectful, but you take my meaning. I could have punched his big, elegant face. Now we were needed. Now we were wanted. I suppose that was what Locke had picked up on, only too late to be useful. The enemy had known more than we had, it seemed. One way or another, someone would have come for us, and only we ourselves had been ignorant of where the tides were headed. There's a limit to how much resentment you can indulge in, however. I was a servant of the Emperor, after all, and for all Navradaran's infuriating manner, I had no doubt he was right about the time of crisis. The galaxy had split in two, and the Astronomicon had gone out. Half of me expected to reach Terra to find it already lain waste. Not that I would have ever disclosed that thought to my more pious companions. So on the final approaches, when the enduring abundance crashed through the raging warp like a Cetacean wallowing in crude oil, its engines spluttering and its ancient hull creaking, there were no illusions. We suited up, we prepared our blades, we prepped the landers. We were travelling into the Inferno, that we knew. But nothing could have prepared me, not really. I might not have had a soul, but I had an intellect, and I had emotions, and neither of them helped with what we found once we broke the veil. The enduring abundance burned inwards from the Mandeville Point at full speed, kicking in plasma drives the moment the warp bubble ripped open. The rest of the fleet came through with it, clustered together to make the best use of the Black Ship's superior navigation and power. I never saw any of this. I was already in my lander, a heavy slab of adamantium slung under a big launch claw in the outer hull. I was there with four of my sisters. One of them, Reva, had come from a convent like me, one based on the agri world of Otessia, and shared much of my slow-burn fury at the way we had been treated. The other three were crew taken from the League of Black Ships, and they professed themselves unable to understand our lingering disgruntlement. They were strange, grim-faced women, and I doubted they'd have been likable even if they had possessed souls. I found out later that our ingress had almost ended there, shot to pieces on the broadside of the Imperial cruiser in his manifest constancy. The enduring abundance, it seemed, had no intention of slowing down for challenge hails, and it was only Navradaran's presence over a frosty vidlink that prevented us from being annihilated, before we'd even set eyes on the throne world. The entire system, it became apparent, was already in turmoil. The naval cordon was vast, but something had got to the crews. Ships had collided, defense stations had found themselves overrun by spontaneous outbreaks of madness. Energy coils had overloaded and wiped out whole gun platforms. Most of the truly heavy battlecruisers had already been recalled to Terran orbit, and so a veritable cavalcade of heavy voidcraft was churning its way towards system center, streaming back to the source to assist in the incursion that had bypassed all of them and struck at the throne world direct. I couldn't know any of this, of course, closeted as I was in the narrow, cramped crew bay of the lander. All I could sense was the jawbreak rattle of the pressed metal deck as the outer doors of the black ship began to cantilever open. Under normal circumstances, it would have taken us days to negotiate the tortuous approaches to Terra's orbital space. Now we were making the entire journey in a matter of hours, propelled by gargantuan engines running at full tilt. It was like arriving at some vast citadel and finding no one was home, the battlements manned by ghosts and madmen. As the huge roar of the plasma drives began to wind down, we knew we'd arrived. I felt the lander swing away, carried out and down by the enormous extending arms. I could imagine how it looked from the outside. A sliver of metal suddenly thrust from the embrace of the Enduring Abundance, slick black outer armor, tiny against its bulbous hide. Rune screeds appeared in front of me, hanging in the air from my armor's lithcast bead. I still hadn't got used to these tricks, these little machine spirit devices that made my current equipment so much better than the dregs I'd made do with for so long. I only needed to study a few lines. Imperial Palace under active assault. Concentration of forces at Lionsgate Major Intersection. Coordinates are being sent to your landers. Defense response underway. Make planetfall and liaise with assets already in theater. The Emperor guide your blades. It was all happening so fast. We had our assigned squads, our lines of command developed over the preceding days. Most of those on board had been in transit for longer than I had, and so the thrust into action had not come so suddenly. But even so, I felt hardly prepared. I looked over at Reva. Ready? I signed.
Always. You?
Of course not. She smiled, and I liked what I saw. I couldn't see her mouth, just her eyes, but they glittered with genuine mirth. Something heavy slammed out of place below us, and the lander trembled. I had a sudden impression of us hanging like a leaf in autumn, shaking in the cold wind before being torn from the bow. Then the bolts pulled back, the lander's thrusters boomed into life, and we were thrown into our dizzying descent. I slammed back against my restraints, as did my companions. We shook and we juddered, enveloped in the numinous roar of those incredibly powerful thrusters. Soon a greater roar overtook even those, and the whole temperature began to rise. I switched to a tactical external feed, and a vidlink of our progress flickered into jerky life across one of the roof-mounted lenses. The forward view was burning. For a moment I thought something had set us on fire, but then realized I was looking at the entire world's troposphere. The fires were both immense and ethereal, as unnatural as the sham flames conjured by the Shedim, but presumably still deadly. I had a quick glimpse of other craft on our trajectory. Tear-shaped interception landers, bulkier armored caskets like our own, even steeply angled naval gunships, before the burning clouds raced up to envelop us. The lander kicked and jumped as it hit the turbulence, and we were thrown about like straw in the thresher. My head slammed against my restraints, opening a cut that ran from my eyebrow to my cheek. First blood to this rust bucket, I thought grimly, reaching to wipe it away. We screamed earthwards, and the lander's guidance thrusters pulled us down and down into a near vertical dive before eventually kicking into an arresting counterblast. The vibrations became bone-bruising, the noise deafening, the deceleration crushing. We hit the ground with a mighty crack, and immediately the crew doors blasted open. My restraints shot back into their grooves, and we were moving, springing from our seats and reaching for our weapons. I was first out, running down the ramp with Reva at my shoulder. It was then that I first set eyes on Terra. For so long, the distant inspiration for all I had ever done. Holy Terra, the home of saints and the seat of He who preserves, the destination of all pilgrims and the origin of our species. I could have vomited, I could have wept, and I would have done both, assuredly, had the madness and the devilry around me not reached out with both hands and tried to kill me. So I did what I had been brought for. I killed right back.
Chapter 16. Tyrion. I do not remember much of that first meeting, high up in Luna's thin air, surrounded by the starship tombs. I was overwhelmed by his presence, I suppose, as well as by my age and frailty. All I have from that first brief encounter are the impressions it left on me. I do not know how long it had taken him to reach us. I never found out later, either. I heard snatches from those who would become the great powers in our new Imperium, and I could scarcely believe them, even though I had no reason to doubt the speakers. In future years, our scholars may piece together just what the sequence of events was, and assign official date signs to them. My own supposition is that Cadia fell months before we became aware of it, and that the Great Rift opened long before its effects reached us on Terra. Rumors have come to my ears of the links between the events of the Eye and the resurrection of the Primarch on distant Ultramar, though I cannot make proper sense of them, and there is much that I suspect would damn me as a heretic were I to pursue it. All this notwithstanding, it became clear to me that the journey undertaken by the Lord Gilliman had been arduous in the extreme, a crusade that had taken him halfway across the galaxy even as it tore itself apart. Time may have passed for them, very differently, I suppose, for when they spoke of that pilgrimage, they gave the impression of months adrift on the ether's currents, fighting enemies I could scarcely comprehend, let alone picture. He did not speak of that when we met, of course. None of his captains or advisers did. They had just fought a terrible battle in that place, and their speech was heavy with weariness. I never discovered who exactly it was they fought there. No one who knew would tell me, and I understood enough of Imperial law and custom not to press the matter. We must have exchanged a few words more. I must have told him who the Lords of Terra were, and what had transpired to bring such turmoil to the world of his creation. I must have tried to tell him something of what we had been trying to do, to bring the Adeptus Custodes into the war, to reform our armies into something that might oppose the Despoiler more effectively. Though I wonder if he found such scant musings comical or irritating. It was hard to look directly at him. I don't know why that was. It was as if the light reflecting from his face came from a source denied to us, a sun that none who beheld him could see. He spoke softly. He was reasonable, even solicitous. Every command he gave was issued in the same calm, authoritative manner. All obeyed him instantly, not just the Space Marines who shared his lineage, but the Mechanicus Constructs, the living saints who accompanied that strange cavalcade, even the custodians sent from Terra. It felt then as if we had been waiting for him for a long time without knowing it. Now that he was here among us, a terrible doubt began to lift, for a time at least. And yet, I could not envy him. In rare moments I would catch a phenomenal degree of pain present in those steady blue eyes. I might catch him looking at the grotesquely over-militarized docks of Luna, or the battle-battered ships hanging in orbit above us, and see a shadow of astonishment passing across a front of patrician reserve. You may find Terra different to how you remember it, Lord, I said to him before we made Planetfall. Looking back at that, I cringe. Of course it would be different. He had already seen enough of the Imperium to know that. But of course, I was extrapolating into a past I only knew from half-understood historical records. I envisioned the world he had come from as a paradise of accomplishment. And of course, I might have been wrong about that. Perhaps his pain came from a different source. Perhaps I misinterpreted him entirely. After all, who was I to judge the mind of a Primarch? He was as far above me as I was above the spine roaches that we had allowed to infest the throne world's sewers. A little later, the custodian shield captain, Adronitis, led our delegation to the warship that would carry us back to Terra. I was honored to travel with them, one of very few mortals who did. I was surrounded by figures I found daunting to look at, let alone address. Space Marine Lords, Mechanicus Magi, Grey Knight Commanders. I took my place among them, ignored by all, and silently watched what unfolded. At that stage, the brutal assault on the Lion's Gate had not even begun. Before we set off, I thought of the unrest on Terra, the terror in the skies and the visions in the night, and assumed then that we would finally see it all quelled. We passed swiftly from Luna's orbit, escorted by many ships from the task force sent in haste. Tidings were passed in the strictest confidence to the Sanctum Imperialis, and landing permits arranged for the Eternity Wall Voidport. It felt surreal even to be there. It felt surreal that any of it was happening at all. Of course, the Lord Gilliman's procession into the palace is now a story well known and told many times by many souls. The Ecclesiarchy has issued more vids of this single event than they did over 1,000 years previously. Everyone has heard tell of the enormous crowds of well-wishers lining the streets, crying out for joy and reaching out to grasp the hem of his cloak. Well, it didn't quite happen that way. At least, not as I witnessed it. There were crowds, indeed, against all our intentions, for somehow the rumor managed to scamper ahead of us. We came down inside the perimeter of the outer palace, far from the worst of the unrest, and so the Primarch's first sight of his subjects was the most favorable it could possibly have been. The scholiasts, the palace guards, the priests, and the ministers of state. And yet, I could barely look at him during that terrible time. We could not hide just how desperate things had become. He could see for himself the unnatural storms raging in the atmosphere and witness the darkened profile of the defunct Astronomicum fortress. He could see the walls stuffed with defenders and the smouldering half-derelict stretches of the city beyond the walls. Perhaps, worst of all, even when we got him inside the intact precincts to the holiest and most immaculate of our citadels, he looked at them as if they were some kind of insult. I watched it from a distance, my stomach churning to witness a great soul dragged into such a cesspit. I looked around me at the grime-choked aquilae, at the racks of guns defiling the angel-crowned parapets,